think from here out in Genesis we need to do something that we have not been doing. We've been making comments on what the events are without actually reading them, and that's assuming that you know what the event is. So in introducing chapter 40 of Genesis, the first thing we need to note that the chapter is symmetrical, and we'll put the symmetry down and then read it that way. So our first point is this. Genesis chapter 40 is symmetrically arranged. We have pointed out at other times how you have the antithetical parallelism where you have symmetry, and some of this is important to grasp simply because it is part of the structure of the way the chapters are put together, and it's also probably the most telling argument that you have against the documentary hypothesis. The documentary hypothesis simply says this, that the books of Genesis, Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers, and Deuteronomy were not written by Moses. They were written by various redactors. And the redactors were simply men who came along, and each one added to what the previous one said his own theories and thoughts about God. And the early redactor theory was that in the book of Genesis through Deuteronomy, they were written by J-E-D-P. And the J-E-D-P means the first one is the man who believed that Yahweh was God. The second one who came along took that work and edited it, and he was the Elohist, believing that Elohim was God. And therefore, whenever you see Jehovah or Yahweh, that's this first author. Whenever you see Elohim, you've got the second author. Then later on, along came a Deuteronomic redactor, and he redacted and did his editing, and then later on there was a P document or a priestly document, and you still see in commentaries the ridiculous trying to unscramble eggs and saying, this verse is from this author, this verse is from a different author. None of the ones ever agree, but nonetheless the point is that it was put together by redactors. And two things, or two arguments against redactors. Of course, the first one is very simple. The books of the Pentateuch are claimed to be written by Moses. But one thing you have to keep in mind with a liberal critic, whenever you begin with the book of the Bible, whoever claims to have written it is the last person in the world that could have written it. And if you read their works, you find that out. And when you see some of the structure like this symmetry, you begin to see that you have evidence that the book was arranged symmetrically, and the chances of several redactors or authors coming along and coming up with this is impossible. And so the symmetry is this. You have, first of all, a meeting of Joseph with the cupbearer and the baker of Pharaoh. The meeting is followed by the closing out of the chapter where there is a forgetting of Joseph. Then, after the meeting, you have an inquiry, which is verses 5 through 8, and that is matched by a fulfillment. We'll read this and see it in a minute. A fulfillment. And the fulfillment is found in 20 through 22. Then you have a double explanation. An explanation of the first dream in 9 through 13. And it is matched at the end by the explanation of the second dream. And that is found in 16 through 19. And in the middle, you have Joseph's request. And that is found in verses 14 and 15. So that part for part matches. Let's read the first, the meeting. Then it came about after these things, the cupbearer and the baker for the king of Egypt offended their lord, the king of Egypt. And Pharaoh was furious with these two officials, the chief cupbearer and the chief baker. So he put him in confinement in the place where the captain of the bodyguard in the jail, the same place where Joseph was in prison. And the captain of the bodyguard put Joseph in charge of them, and he took care of them, and they were in confinement for some time. So the first paragraph then marks off the way Joseph meets the officials from the house of Pharaoh. Their relationship develops, and then the chapter closes with Joseph's last relationship, where it says, the chief cupbearer did not remember Joseph, but forgot him. So the meeting at the beginning matches the forgiving at the end with the request to be remembered in between. Then you have an inquiry, and that begins in verse 5. Then the cupbearer and the baker for the king of Egypt, who were confined in jail, both had a dream the same night, each man with his own dream and each dream with its own interpretation. And when Joseph came to them in the morning and observed them, behold, they were rejected. And here is the inquiry. He said to them, we have had a dream. Verse 7. He asked the Pharaoh's officials who were with him in confinement in his master's house, why are your faces so sad today? And they said to him, we have had a dream. There's no one to interpret it. And Joseph said to them, do not interpretations belong to God? Tell it to me, please. And that inquiry is matched by the fulfillment in verse 20. Thus it came about on the third day, which was Pharaoh's birthday, that he made a feast for all his servants. He lifted up the head of the chief cupbearer, the head of the chief baker among his servants, and he restored the chief cupbearer to his office, and he put the cup to Pharaoh's hand. But he hanged the chief baker, just as Joseph had interpreted to them. And notice that just as Joseph had interpreted goes back to the inquiry, yet the chief cupbearer did not remember Joseph, but forgot him. Then you have the explanation of the two dreams in pairs. The first one is in verse 9. So the chief cupbearer told his dream to Joseph, and he explains it down through verse 11. Then in verse 12, Joseph said to him, this is the interpretation. That's the explanation of first dream. The explanation of the second is in verse 16. When the chief baker saw that he had interpreted favorably, he said to Joseph, and he relates the dream. And then in verse 18, Joseph answered and said, this is the interpretation, and he interprets it for him. And then right in the middle of all of this, you have verses 14 and 15. And verses 14 and 15 is the most aggressive Joseph ever gets. He says, only keep me in mind when it goes well with you, and please do me a kindness by mentioning me to Pharaoh, and get me out of this house. For I was, in fact, kidnapped from the land of the Hebrews, and even here I have done nothing that they should have put me into the dungeon. So you have symmetry in Genesis chapter 40. And as we said, the possibility of one writer followed by another writer followed by another writer ever putting this together is impossible. Also, by way of introduction to chapter 40 of Genesis, we have a key to its interpretation. And that is Psalm 105, 17 through 19 is the key to interpretation of the chapter. Keep your finger here, but go to Psalm 105. Psalm 105 is a divinely inspired interpretation on how we ought to look at Joseph in prison in chapter 40. Okay, the reference down at verse 16 is first of all to the famine that was coming. And the psalmist says, he called, that is, God called for a famine upon the land. He broke the whole staff of bread. He sent a man before them, referring to Israel, Joseph, who was sold as a slave. They afflicted his feet with fetters. He himself was laid in irons until the time that his word came to pass. The word of the Lord tested him. So that, coming then in this section, we have several things. Number one, in verse 17, we have a focus on one primary cause of Joseph being in Egypt, and B, secondary cause for his being in Egypt. And they're both found in the two parts of verse 17. First, the primary cause. He, God, sent a man before them. So from divine perspective of the primary cause, how did Joseph get to Egypt? God sent him to Egypt. The second line looks at the secondary cause or the human cause, Joseph, who was sold as a slave. So notice in verse 17 you have two reasons for his being down in Egypt. One, again, is God sent him, and number two, his brothers sold him. One is primary, other is secondary. So primary cause, God. Secondary cause, his brothers sold him. And that's the first key to the interpretation of Genesis chapter 40 as to how he got there. Second, if you go back and keep the psalm open, but look at chapter 40 and verse 3. So he put them in confinement in the same house of the captain of the bodyguard in the jail, the same place where Joseph was, and here is the word imprisoned. And the word imprisoned means to be bound. It means that Joseph was not free to walk around however he wanted. So don't think of a modern place of incarceration where the only thing that held him in was walls and he was free to walk about as he wished. That modern idea of a jail is not the one that they used in Egypt. And therefore, they chained him, or in verse 3, the word imprisoned means Joseph was bound. Now go back to Psalm 105 for some explanation of that, and we have some details. First of all, we know that they put his feet in fetters, and that's verse 18. They afflicted his feet with fetters. And second, he himself was laid in irons. Irons would be weights to keep him from escaping, and therefore there were leg irons, doubtless, around his legs, and his feet were fettered, so he could not move about in a free way. And that all interprets what the passage means when it says he was imprisoned. The second idea that is involved is the psalmist gives us a clear statement of the purpose of his imprisonment. Why was he in prison? If you look at that from the human standpoint, he was in prison because of a lying woman. And Joseph could have done a lot of thinking about, well, she lied to me, and have very easily, or lied about me, very easily become bitter over that situation. However, notice, God had another purpose, and that purpose is found in verse 19. And it's the way we've got to look at chapter 40. He was there until the time that his word came to pass. The word of the Lord tested him. So we know now then the purpose of the imprisonment was to test Joseph. He was on trial and God was testing the man's faith in this particular context. The word that is translated test is literally a word, saref, or a verb, saref, that means to smelt. For its usage in that way, let's look at Isaiah 1:25 and Jeremiah 6:29. The word is used many times, but these are just a couple of samples, that the idea is to refine, to purge out dross. He was put in the heat to refine him. First, Isaiah 1. And verse 25. And this is the same word that describes what God was doing to Joseph. God speaks to Israel, and he says in 25, I will turn my hand against you and smite away, or smelt away, your dross as with lye. And the word that's used there is the word smelled. And it's a metaphor of putting the heat to something in order to get rid of the dross. Jeremiah also, 6:29. The word's used many times, just a couple of samples of it. Verse 29 of chapter 6 of Jeremiah reads, as God speaks to Israel, "The bellows blow fiercely, the lead is consumed by the fire, in vain the refining," that's the word, "goes on." And so the idea then that we ought to have in chapter 40 is the prison is Joseph's furnace in order to test his faith. Now, how would it be a test of his faith? Well, remember the first dream he had, the first two dreams he had indicated he was to be a mighty ruler, and others, including his brothers, were to bow at his feet. Well, does it look like that's going to happen? First thing that happened to him is he got sold. That's not being a leader. That was a test. And here he is in prison, not in a place of leadership, and it is also a test of his faith. So the test is to see this. Will God's promise, will God be faithful to His promise of leadership? And God will not simply allow Joseph to say, "I hear the promise, I believe you," that's all there is to it. God says, "I'll make the promise, now you got to face the test." So, very important. Promise, inevitably, in the Old Testament, is always followed by test. Promise is always followed by test. Or tests is the principle. And it was true with Abraham, remember, is that he was promised a seed. Sarah could have children, could not have children. And then he has a child by Hagar, and this is not it. And some 23 years exist between God's promise to Abraham and the test. And the same is true with Joseph. Joseph, 17 years old, and at 17 years old he is promised greatness, and the following years, about 13 of them, are nothing but test after test after test after test. And this is one of them. Here is our promised leader, feet tied, can't move, in jail. Is God faithful to His promise? And Joseph gets to do a lot of thinking about that while he is located there in prison. Okay, and we're simply going to list points, I think, tonight rather than try to outline so much. So, point number three is we open with two providential events in verses 1 through 4. And the two events are, number one, the offense of Pharaoh's servants. And that's in verses 1 through 3. Important thing to note, by the way, at that point, is that in verse 1, they didn't just commit some silly goof-up. And Pharaoh... That's kind of when we read through, you kind of have the idea that Pharaoh must have been very picky or very touchy, and these cupbearer and the baker didn't do anything all that bad. Well, that is not conveyed by the text, because if you read verse 1, it says, "It came about after these things, the cupbearer and the baker for the king," and then there is the Hebrew word, what's the Hebrew word, main word for sin, you know? Missed the mark? Chata. And that is translated offended. They sinned against their Lord. So this is not just a careless lapse in some way. They really did something wrong. Remember, to hata, the word for sin, the most common word for sin, means to miss the mark. So in some way, their duty, their job, they failed to do, and therefore their imprisonment was a legitimate thing, and it's not simply looking at a touchy Pharaoh that had a chip on his shoulder and he was waiting to get mad at something anyway. They sinned against their Lord. the king of Egypt. Well, with that, you have the second providential event that meets the first, and that is in verse 4, the assignment of Joseph. So two things providentially work together. Number one, the servants sinned at the right time. They got put in jail at the right time. Joseph was there, and you have the note of the two things meeting in verse 4. The captain of the bodyguard put Joseph in charge of them, and he took care of them, and they were in confinement for some time. So that he is assigned to care for their daily needs, and that would naturally build an acquaintance with two high Egyptian officials, and this is going to be the beginning of the road to the top for him. Now, when we talk about the assignment of Joseph to take care of them, notice this. Unjust treatment did not hinder Joseph's faithful service. Unjust treatment. Did not give Joseph cause to be unfaithful. And you can see the turn that his mind could easily take. I'm here because of a lie, and Pharaoh wouldn't listen to my case. Why should I work and put forth effort? I'll just do a passable job. Not Joseph. Joseph did such a good job that the jailer said, I don't even need to check on you, and we'll close out the you have the latter part of the chapter, chapter 39, with the jailer didn't even check because he was faithful. If there's anything that is underscored in the life of Joseph, is he was always, always faithful, whether treated right or treated wrongly. How much is that a principle? That even if treated wrongly, we're still supposed to be faithful. 1 Peter 2:18. It's a parallel New Testament truth to go along with this. 1 Peter 2:18 is the New Testament counterpart. Realizing that when mistreated, it would be very easy to respond by saying, oh, well, you weren't fair anyway. So since you were not fair, I'll just do my own thing. Not at all. Though that was a temptation, and because it was a temptation, Peter addresses the issues with servants. 2:18, servants, be submissive to your masters with all respect, not only to those who are good and gentle, but also to those who are unreasonable. So notice the unreasonableness of the one to whom we're responsible in no sense of the word allows us out of responsibility, and Joseph practices that principle back in the Old Testament where we're looking. All right? Third observation to make, and this is coming off of the centerpiece or the request of Joseph. Notice that the sovereignty of God did not preclude Joseph using reasonable means to get out of jail. Sovereignty of God did not preclude the use of means. In other words, Joseph did not say, well, I'm here, God is sovereign, there's nothing I can do, there's nothing I should do. And notice how verse 14 and 15 negate that. He says to the cupbearer, keep me in mind when it goes well with you, and please do me a kindness by mentioning me to Pharaoh, and get me out of this house. For I was in fact kidnapped from the land of the Hebrews, and even here I have done nothing that they should put me in dungeon. Now, several things are there. Number one, did the cupbearer forget him or not? And the answer is yes and no. He forgot him at first, but then he remembered him. And if we would want to argue that, well, Joseph was using a means and he should have just let God do it, that is only to go as far as verse 23. Verse 23 says, yet the chief cupbearer did not remember Joseph, but forgot him. But that is not the end of the story, is it? Because when you come down to chapter 41 and verse 9, it says, then the chief cupbearer spoke to Pharaoh, saying, I would make mention today of my own offenses. And he tells how Joseph had interpreted his dream and so forth. So we can say this, the cupbearer forgot Joseph at first, but the cupbearer remembered Joseph later in chapter 41 and verse 9, and it was the means whereby he was brought into the presence of Pharaoh and how he will be exalted to prime minister in chapter 41. This has a New Testament counterpart also. Should we simply accept our lot in life and say it's the sovereignty of God? Or is it reasonable that we can use a means to get out? 1 Corinthians 7. Verse 21. Were you called while a slave? Don't worry about it. And that does not mean that you resign yourself to being a slave, but you're not overly concerned about it. But does it mean that if you get a chance to be free, you shouldn't take it? Well, the latter part shows that. He says, do not worry about it, but if you're able also to become free, do that, or rather do that. So notice the fact that you're to relax, or we're to relax in the sovereign placement of God. And yet at the same time, if you get a chance to go free, go free. So they balance out beautifully. Okay? The fifth thing we ought to note here in looking at the chapter and making an observation on the chapter is this. God was moving at this point to bring Joseph to ascendancy. God was moving to bring Joseph to ascendancy, but none of the circumstances look like it. None of the circumstances look like it. And that is an important principle because appearances are almost always deceiving. Well, how would you know if you didn't see something later on that the coming of these people into prison and Joseph's taking care of them was going to be the road to leadership of the entire nation of Egypt? You would have never guessed it. And this carries with it another principle, and that is simply this. God's leading, or God's hand, is seen in retrospect. In other words, the hand of God in one's life is more often seen when you look over your shoulder than when you look forward. When you look forward, or look at the present, you must simply trust that what God has said about all things work together for good. This is happening. You don't examine the circumstances. You don't try to take them apart. You simply say, I know, as a matter of fact, that God is working on behalf of my best interest and my good and His glory. Then you have the privilege sometimes of looking back over your shoulder and say, oh, I see now. And at the time, Joseph could have only seen these men as two prisoners to be managed, no particular part in the plan of God for me, but they're simply there and I'll faithfully serve, but they don't have a key part. They did have a key part. And if you've been a believer for any number of years, how many times can you look over your shoulder? And at the time, 10 years ago, 15 years ago, all the circumstances seemed to indicate that God was doing nothing. Or at least if He was doing nothing, He was doing the wrong thing with respect to your life. But now you look back, and you're 10, 15 years down the road, and you say, I see now how he put the pieces together. And this is exactly what's going to happen with Joseph. Joseph has no idea that these men are going to be so critical and so key in his life, but he will be able to see it in retrospect. All right, with verse 5 then, let's focus on the dreams of the prisoners. That runs verse 5 through 8. I think we've got a very clear revelation in these verses about the attitude of Joseph. That Joseph did not engage in self-pity. Joseph, as we said, was there unjustly, but he didn't sit around and say, poor me. How do we know that? Because he was concerned with the emotional condition of others. And people who are engaged in self-pity are not concerned about others, are we? When we engage in self-pity, we're focused on our problem, our needs, and heck with your problem and your needs, we're not concerned with those. Well, that's not Joseph. And it is a lead-in that this man did not sit around and engage in self-pity, because he comes in the morning in verse 7. He asks Pharaoh's officials who are with him in confinement in his master's house, why your face is so sad today? Notice the outgoing concern for them. And they said to him, we've had a dream and there's no one to interpret it. Then Joseph said to them, do not interpretations belong to God? Tell it to me, please. And therefore, the dreams reveal Joseph's attitude. And we'll put his attitude expressed negatively. There was no self-pity. And that is indicated by the fact that he is concerned. A person wrapped up in his own problems is not likely to be concerned about the problems of others, and yet Joseph was. That shows that he was not wrapped up in his own concern. He certainly didn't have a chip on his shoulder. He could have, if it had a chip on his shoulders, he said, you rascals, you're here because you deserve it. I'm here because I don't. What are you sad for? Not Joseph. Joseph was there unjustly, but he did not, in any sense of the word, have a chip on his shoulders. When you come down to verse 8, you have the statement of the prisoners, and the Hebrew word order here is important. They said to him, a dream we have dreamed, and an interpreter, dash, none. A dream we have dreamed, and an interpreter, none. And so Joseph replies, and notice that Joseph's doctrine is sound. Joseph's doctrine is sound. And basically it is this. Truth comes only from God. Solid doctrine. It's very interesting. When truth was needed, Joseph was there and had the privilege of being there in that context. And consequently, in the midst of this, he was present. Philippians 1:12. Philippians 1:12. God rarely does his finest work in good circumstances. It's always in the midst of a mess that God works. And we have read this verse previously. It's very similar to what you had in the life of Joseph. He says, I want you to know, brethren, that the circumstances have turned out for the greater progress of the gospel. So the idea involved is that though he is in unpleasant circumstances, it's been good. Typical way of divine working. 2 Timothy 2, 8 and 9. Notice that the circumstances are treated as irrelevant to the spread of truth. Remember, verse 8, Jesus Christ, risen from the dead, descendant of David, according to my gospel, for which I suffer hardship even to imprisonment as a criminal. But it doesn't make any difference. See the rest of the verse? But the Word of God is not imprisoned. And there is Joseph in prison, but Joseph has truth. And when he has truth, God is able to use that truth in the fullest sense of the Word. Well, coming down to verse 9, you've got the dream explanations. Verse 9, the chief cupbearer told his dream to Joseph and said to him, in my dream, behold, there was a vine in front of me. And he tells about the 3 days and the vine and so forth, and how in verse 12, Pharaoh's cup was in my hand, so I took the grapes and squeezed them into Pharaoh's cup, and I put the cup into Pharaoh's hand. How's that for service? Beautiful. Squeeze my orange juice, put it in my cup, and hand it to me. And he gets the interpretation that things are going to turn out favorably for him. Then the other dream is interpreted, and you have a little play on words about lifting up the head. At verse 13, within 3 more days, Pharaoh will lift up your head. And lifting up the head does not mean cut it off. In this context, lift up the head means to restore to a place of leadership. It's used that way in the psalm. The same thing is used later on for the baker, and that's in verse 19, within 3 more days, Pharaoh will lift your head from you. And this does mean he's going to get hanged. So sort of a play on words, one head gets lifted in favor, the other's head gets lifted in terms of being hanged. And the interpretation of that is stated clearly by the context that is there. Well, with that, we have the fulfillments of them coming down to verses 20 through 23. Now, just in closing, an introduction to chapter 41. Chapter 41, we will call this the sovereignty of God over the world power of Joseph's day. Sovereignty of God over the world power of the day. And that world power, of course, was Egypt. Now, we'll introduce it next time, but just before we leave, and we have time to do it, notice first of all how God moves in Joseph's dreams from the lesser to the greater. Remember his first dream in chapter 37? What was it about? It was concerning himself. The next dream that Joseph had in chapter 40 and verse 8 that we just looked at was an interpretation of a dream about others. And now, in chapter 41 and verse 1, it happened at the end of 2 full years that Pharaoh had a dream, and this dream is going to affect the interpretation of what's going to happen in the whole world Egyptian empire. So from Joseph to others to the world, God leads him in a slow manner. The ability, there's a parallel here also, and the parallel is between Daniel and Joseph. Think through with Daniel and Joseph. In each case, 4 things were true. Number 1, a Hebrew slave was summoned to interpret a ruler's dream. That happened with Daniel, did it not? It happened with Joseph. Number 2, when that Hebrew slave comes in, the king explains the dream that his wise men couldn't interpret. That was true with Daniel. That was true with Joseph. Third, by the help of God, the Hebrew slave interprets the dream. Daniel did it, Joseph did it. And fourth, as a result of that interpretation, the world ruler elevates the Hebrew slave to a place of great power. A few other similarities between the two. Joseph and Daniel were both in bondage in a foreign land when the events took place. In both cases, the dreams of the rulers demonstrated that God was controlling the destiny of the major nations of the world. Behind the rise of Joseph was the diminishing of the power of the Pharaoh. Later on, another Pharaoh's power will be diminished, and who will the leader be? Another Hebrew named Moses. And so we'll have that occurring. Also in chapter 41 and verse 41, you've got the apex of Joseph's career. In 41:41, Pharaoh said to Joseph, "See, I have set you over all the land of Egypt." And God's sovereign control over Egypt will be set forth in chapter 41, which we'll pick up with next time. Father, once again, we thank you for the life of Joseph, for the obvious care that you exert on your servant, for your hand being upon him. And we pray that we will learn, like Joseph, to trust your faithfulness and recognize that every promise must be accompanied by a test. And yet, you can be trusted. May we learn to do it in Christ's name.